And that's right, don't laugh at me. This here is Big Dot, better known as Missionary Kenneth Wolfgang, with you on another Jumbo Braille program here on the Six Eyes Radio Network. The one and only program here on the Six Eyes Radio Network that can be felt, saying welcome one, welcome all to the program tonight, especially our surrounding city and states, and our country is near and far, as well as those who've called 424-243-9617. Again, 424-243-9617. Press the number one, join the conversation. Tonight, we will be finishing our series on the Ashtabula Horror, better known as the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster, which was the railroad disaster that happened in 1876, December 29th, 1876, that horrible disaster which took the life of the well-known songwriter P.P. Bliss, as well as many others, that fateful night, that winter night. And we will be discussing that as we continue tonight. But first, we just want to see who's all with us tonight. Ghost Dot, who do we got?
Well, we got the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. It's usually a big crowd, and we just don't see them, but we know they're there. We have you, we have Emily, and her dad with me.
Okay. So how you doing tonight, Emily? She's got to get her coffee.
Well, it took me a little bit to open the mic. It might be that, too, but it's on now.
Your mic is open, Em. Get your coffee.
Sorry about that. I accidentally bumped the mute.
Ah. So how you doing tonight?
Fiddling with my fingers and toes.
Ah. Well, we've had for the last 2 weeks, we've been talking about the Ashtabula Bridge disaster, better known as the Ashtabula Horror. And we've covered so far all about how they've allowed when the train wrecked into the Ashtabula Gorge or the Ashtabula Gulf, how the citizens of Ashtabula tried to help. But the horrible part about how they allowed the train to burn when it started on fire, we found that out. We heard testimonies of survivors and heard about those who were found as those who were deceased. But now we'll be coming tonight, Emily, on the testimony and information on P.P. Bliss tonight. We'll be discussing him tonight. And now what some people know was found in the baggage car. They did manage to locate this. See, it was written, the words were written by another, Spafford was the name of the guy who wrote the words to the song It Is Well. But he wrote the music to the song It Is Well. So we'll be playing that and talking about that particular song tonight, as well as P.P. Bliss himself, about his life, etc. And then we'll be discussing tonight what the most interesting part, Emily, something that you'll be interested in finding out, what caused the bridge to collapse itself? What they actually found out? What caused the problem? And then, of course, the engineer. We're not talking about engineer as in the guy who runs the locomotive on the train. We're talking engineer as in someone who builds something. The engineer Collins, there was a controversy whether he committed suicide or whether he was murdered. We'll be talking about that tonight. And, of course, finally, some lessons learned from the disaster. So we'll be covering a lot of ground tonight. So are you interested to hear what's going to happen as we end tonight now?
Yeah, but I got somebody over here that wants to say howdy.
Okay.
Hi.
How you doing?
Well, we were talking about that train disaster, and I used to live on Riverside Drive, which is literally around the corner from that cemetery. And I don't know if you know about the monument that's there in honor of all.
Yeah, we do.
People.
In fact, we'll be in tonight's broadcast, we'll be even be discussing the monument itself, how that came about. And so that'll be also interesting for you to find out about that, how that came into being.
Well, I can't stay on because I just came from a test and I just took some Valium to relax me because I didn't like MRIs and closed spaces scare me. So I'm probably going to go to bed, but I just thought I'd chime in about it because I found it very interesting as I walked through and found out all about the train disaster because I had just moved to Ohio. So.
Right. Well, Emily could help you later. She could actually get these episodes later, put them on her phone, and then once she has the episode, she could play them back for you later.
Also, you could put them on thumb drive for me, Ken.
Right. We could do that as well. That way you could play them on your computer, and she'd be able to listen back to them and get all the information from the very beginning. So I think she'd find that interesting. So if everybody's ready, I think we'll
Kenny,
get... Yeah.
Kenny, just to have our ministry as well as our listeners to be praying for...
My aunt passed, Sandy Ryder. So,
okay.
Yeah. I found out.
Okay.
She found out about 3 a.m. this morning, so.
Cirrhosis of the liver.
So she hasn't been doing that kosher.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely keep that in prayer. So if everybody's ready, we are ready to start tonight.
Let's do it.
Okay, here we go. For part three, which is our final part on the Ashtabula Horror, the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster, and here we go. The following is a true story of the Ashtabula Bridge Disaster, which occurred in December 29, 1876. However, there are details of this accident which may be too sensitive for some listeners, so listener discretion is advised. It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night. Snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Ashtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Ashtabula Bridge, crossing the Ashtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Ashtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn. The question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time. Find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30, 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 13th, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
Many noble characters were lost to the world in this great calamity. Very few disasters ever reached so far or brought bereavement to so many communities. The breadth of the land was swept by it. There never was so widespread mourning for any death which brought loss to only private circles. It was more like the mourning which follows the death of some public officer, some great and good man, when a nation is called upon to weep. It was indeed almost a national calamity. The very mention of the names of the dead and the places to which they belonged shows how many communities were affected. And the very funerals which were held indicate how many circles were bereaved. They were not all private mourners, nor were they merely different circles of friends sharing in a common sorrow. Churches mourned their beloved pastor or the most useful members
villages, and even counties were made to feel the loss of the skillful physician. The whole land, yes, the world, has been impressed by the silence which came so suddenly upon the tongue of the sweet singer of Israel, and the various circles of society, from the highest to the lowest, were affected by the death which invaded so many classes. Out of the summer of worthy characters, who went down in that awful plunge where so many mourn, it is difficult to select, for it is easy to say many things in praise of all. Indeed, a volume might be written which should contain nothing but the memoirs of the lost. The following sketches are given out of regard to those who so kindly encouraged anybody who was writing anything in the newspaper or doing research, as well as from an admiration of the characters which had been so faithfully portrayed by those who knew the persons well. The name of E.P. Rogers has been mentioned. Of him, Reverend Dr. Collier has spoken, and the following selection from a sermon preached in Chicago is given as descriptive of his character. Speaking of all those who perished in the train, he says, they are lost to this world before their time. Hundreds of homes will have a shadow on them many years. Children are fatherless and motherless. Men and women are weeping. The whole world about us is poorer and sadder, and there is no compensation which can reach the case. Here was our fellow townsman, Mr. Rogers, in the prime of his life, steady and true as the day, a man whose bond you would not want if you had his word, or even his word if you knew he had made up his mind. There were a mother and sister in his old eastern home to whom his presence in the world was as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land, people here trusting their property to him as the soul of prudence and honor and resting without a fear on his sturdy strength. Gone in the midst of his days with the kiss of his mother and sisters fresh on his mouth, gone with the world in his heart, the sweet, unwholesome world in which he was so glad to live, gone with these things all to be done that only an honest and trusty man can do. Gone from every place that knew him and was glad for him. Gone and then not a trace of him, friendship or kinship or love could recognize. Gone into heaven and wanted on the earth, it is no great comfort, I fear, to those who were very near him, to think of him in the eternal rest. They want him here, and ought to have him here, and would have had him, but for that which human integrity and clear manhood might have prevented. It was such sad things at this that put the most terrible emphasis on this question. God asked, why will ye die? And starts the wonder when we all summon the better spirit to do whatever can be done to put an end to this great disaster, period. The following biographical outlines are given by Reverend L. Hand of Pork City, Iowa. George Francis Hubbard was born in Ipswich, Massachusetts, May 12, 1841, and so had passed his 35th anniversary. His parents removed to Claremore, New Hampshire, before he was a year old, in which place he spent his childhood and youth. He studied at Meriden Academy, Dartmouth College, and Harvard Medical School. His first professional work was at St. John's College Hospital in Annapolis, Maryland, during the war. He came to Polk City 11 years ago last September, and a year later was married to Eliza E. Tone, who survives him with three daughters. His life work had been here. Here he would won his fortune, his good name, and a warm place in the affections of our citizens. During these 11 years, he had applied himself with great diligence to his professional work. Few men have been able to endure so much labor and fatigue. You all know of his long rides, sometimes lost on the prairie in the stormy night, long seeking some known object to guide his way, sometimes swimming his horse across the high river. During this time, he studied to keep abreast with the progress made by his profession, reading medical journals, attending the meetings of the profession, and most of the time directing the reading of the student in his office. Few physicians carry to their patients more of sympathy and personal interest, making his visits professional, more like those of a wise friend than of a professional man. A man who was very intimate with him for years told me that few persons knew how severely he studied his cases. There is a limit to the sympathy any one man can give, but no one could come nearer to carrying every patient upon his heart as though it were that of a personal friend. His bearing was that of modest self-distrust, which forbore claiming to fully understand his work or making large promises of cure. He carried to the sickbed a cheery kindness mingled with that dignity and self-reliance which quickly commanded confidence. As a citizen, he had that public spirit which made him prompt to sustain our educational and religious institutions or any interest that promotes the public weal. As a member of our common council, he stood alone in opposing the change in an ordinance which opened the door for the licensing of saloons in our village. He had long been a member of the orders who have charge of this burial service today. He became a member of this church some 8 years ago, for it he has been faithfully worked and generously given. Many is the long ride I have shared with him when all these matters were fully discussed, and it appeared how closely he cherished and valued these interests of religion. He was by temperament conservative and cautious, not the most hopeful, but his hold was steady and firm to any work to which he applied himself. It will be asked in many circles, how can we get along without him, but nowhere with more feeling and fear than in this little church circle. It is well with my soul, written by Horatio G. Spafford, 1828-1888, music by Philip P. Bliss, 1838-1876. Meter 11, 8, 11, 9 with chorus. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Psalms 46:1. This beloved hymn was written by a Presbyterian layman from Chicago named Horatio G. Spafford, who was born in North Troy, New York on October 20, 1828. The young man Spafford had a successful legal practice in Chicago. Along with his financial success, he was even interested in Christian activities. He enjoyed a close and active relationship with D.L. Moody and other evangelical leaders of that era. He was described by George Stevens, a noted gospel musician, as an unusual intelligence and refinement, deeply spiritual and a devoted student of the scriptures. Some months prior to the Chicago fire of 1871, Spafford had invested heavily in real estate. On the shore of Lake Michigan, in his holdings, work was destroyed by the disaster. Desiring a rest for his wife and four daughters, as well wishing to assist Moody and Sankey in their campaigns in Great Britain, Spafford planned a European trip of 1873 for his family. Due to last-minute developments, he had to remain in Chicago. He sent his wife and four daughters on ahead as scheduled on the SS Villa de Havre, expecting to follow in a few days. On November the 22nd, the ship was struck by the Locker Urn, an English vessel, and sank in 12 minutes. Several days later, the survivors were finally landed at Cardiff, Wales, and Miss Spafford, her husband saved alone. Shortly afterward, Spafford left by ship to join his bereaved wife. It is thought that on the sea, near the area where his four daughters had drowned, Spafford penned this text. His words so significantly described his own personal grief. when sorrows like sea billows roll. It is noteworthy, however, that Spafford's hymn does not dwell on the theme of like sorrows and trials. He focuses attention in the third stanza on the redemptive work of Christ. In the fourth stanza, the glorious second coming. These are, humanly speaking, it is amazing, such personal tragedies that one could experience such personal tragedies and sorrows as Horatio Spafford did, and still being able to say with convincing clarity, it is well with my soul. In 1881, Spafford fulfilled a lifelong interest in the Holy Land. They left Chicago with their two young daughters and a group of friends and settled in Jerusalem. There, they established an American colony which cared for the sick and destitute. Although Horatio died 8 years later at the age of 60, this significant ministry continued. The story of this special family and their ministry is told in the book, Our Jerusalem, written by the Spafford's daughter, Bertha Spafford Vesper. Philip P. Bliss was so impressed with the experience and expression of Spafford's text that he shortly wrote the music for it by P.P. Bliss. First published in one of Sankey Bliss hymnals, Gospel Hymns No. 2 in 1876. Bliss was a prolific writer of gospel songs throughout his brief lifetime. In most cases, he wrote both the words and music for his hymns. His songs, most gospel hymn-y, are strong in emotional appeal with rooms that are easily learned and sung. Other hymns by P.P. Bliss, Hold the Fort, I Gave My Life for Thee, Jesus Loves Even Me, Let the Lower Lights Be Burning, and Once for All.
What?
saddest things connected with the whole calamity and the circumstance which made the event a personal bereavement to many thousands of people was the death of Mr. P.P. Bliss and his wife. His name will always be associated with Ashtabula in the sad memories of that hour, yet there are brighter visions connected with that name, which have a tendency to relieve the gloom of that whole calamity. The very mention of these loved persons brings up the memory of their sweet songs. These songs may be supposed to echo in the air and to spingle with all the mourning so as to give almost a melody to the melancholy sounds. It is indeed a plaintive song, yet there is a hopeful, soul-stirring strain running through it all. The memory of the sweet singer is a joyful, happy one, bringing delightful associations to the minds of all who knew it. Few persons ever endeared themselves to so many people in so short a life, but his spirit delighted others with its very sweetness. The early days of Mr. Bliss were spent in toil. His parents were in humble circumstances, and while yet a youth, his father died, leaving him to meet the obstacles of life with only the counsel of his mother, whom he loved, but depended on his own exertion for a livelihood. For a time, the young man was engaged as a hired hand upon a farm. His home was at this time in the western part of Pennsylvania, where also he received a partial education as a pupil of the collegiate institution in Towanda, Pennsylvania. After a short period of study, he went to Rome, Pennsylvania, and taught a district school. Here he met the lady who became his wife and to whom he ascribed the main part of his success. She was the daughter of O.F. Young, Esquire of Rome, an elder in the Presbyterian Church. He used to say to his friends, "All I am, I owe to my wife." Under the influence received from her, he entered upon the study of music and first felt the stirrings of that gift, which made him so useful. Together they went to Professor Root's Normal Academy at Geneseo, New York, where he made great advancement in music and won the admiration of his gifted teacher. It was, however, in Chicago that his musical career really began, but it is a singular fact that fire was the element that brought out the genius of the man, as well as that in which his spirit was released from his body and borne to higher realms. He often remarked that it was the great fire which made him, because it liberated him from secular occupations and led him to devote himself to the Lord's work. At the time, he was in the employ of the firm of Root and Caddy, but the flames which laid in ruins the great city also swept away his house, and from that event forward, he seemed to have no home except where the service of song might lead him. He became connected with Reverend Dr. Goodwin's church as chorister and superintendent, and there he won all hearts not only by his singing, but by his remarkable devotion as a Christian. The choir meetings were always open with prayer. He spoke and wrote personally to the members of the choir on the subject of religion, and he trained and improved them so that they sung from the impulse of loving and pious hearts. Dr. Goodwin bears testimony to this usefulness in his position and says that Mr. Bliss's services in the choir rendered his ministry more earnest, pleasant, and fruitful. It was, however, in connection with the precious revival work that the genius of Mr. Bliss was brought to the higher flight, which gave such a broad influence and caused his song to be heard throughout the land. About 6 years ago, Major Whittle, and he first ventured out in the gospel work. It was then that he began to put words to music, both of which had sprung from the deep melody of his own heart. At a meeting held in Rockford, Illinois, a story was told which thrilled him with its interest, and then to the inspiration of it, he was a glowing heart, composed that noble song, "Hold the Fort," which has done so much to arouse and cheer the Christian people in every land. From this time, his own hymns inspired the melody which he sang. There was the inspiration of a heart full of love, united in a voice rich and expressive of emotion. The effect of his singing was wonderful. Melting in the fervor of his emotion, with tears filling his eyes, he sang his modest lyrics until every heart owned the spell. He was the author of the most popular songs used in the Moody and Sankey meetings. Anyone who has heard these may know what power they have had in molding character and in stirring souls to a lofty devotion. The hymns, "What Shall the Harvest Be? Whosoever Will, More to Follow, That Will Be Heaven for Me, Almost Persuaded," were written by his pen and the music inspired by his genius. He also wrote the music of many other of the favorite hymns which have been sung by so many thousands of people. He wrote many of his songs upon the sudden inspiration of some incident. For instance, when Mr. Moody at one of his meetings told the story of the wreck of the steamer at Cleveland and said that it was because the lights on the pier were not burning, he was thrilled with the anecdote and expressed with the truth that illustrated at once wrote out the beautiful song, "Let the Lower Lights Be Burning," and set it to music. For the last 3 years, Mr. Bliss has given himself to the work of composing and singing for the revival meetings. This was done through the earnest persuasions of Mr. Moody. His success was very great. It was said at his funeral that probably no other man has ever reached so many hearts by song as he. Mr. Moody said, "This man who has died so young, his hymns are now sung around the world. Only a few days ago, a book came to me from China, and there were his hymns translated into Chinese. They were going into all the world, all around the world." Reverend Dr. Goodwin said that it was joyful thought that though dead, the brother's work had just begun. A little time ago, a friend from South Africa had written how he stopped for a night's rest in the Zulu country when Brother Bliss's song, "Hold the Fort," burst upon his ear from a company of natives, just so his influence for good would spread and increase. Some of his songs seemed to be almost prophetic of his death. The last one, which he sang in the tabernacle just before starting for the East, was one which will always be associated with his name. "I know not the hour when my Lord will come to take me away to his own dear home, but I know that his presence will lighten the gloom, and that will be glory for me. I know not the song that the angels sing. I know not the sound of the harp's glad ring, but I know there'll be mention of Jesus our King, and that will be music for me. I know not the form of my mansion fair. I know not the name that I then shall bear, but I know that my Savior will welcome me there, and that will be heaven for me." Another has been spoken of by a friend as also prophetic even of the manner of his death, although it was composed on the occasion of that other fire which consumed his house and the homes of thousands of others in the doomed city. It reads, "Hark! The alarm, the clang of the bells, signal of danger. It rises and swells, flashes like lightning, illumine the sky. See the red glare as the flames about on high. Roll on, O billows of fire. Dash with thy fury waves, higher and higher. Ours is a mission abiding and sure. Ours is a kingdom eternal, secure. On like a fiend in its towering wrath, on in destruction alone points the path. Mercy, O heaven, the sufferer's wail. Feeble humanity naught can avail." The minute of Mr. Bliss's death was remarkable. He had been with his wife to the home of his parents in Towanda, Pennsylvania, where his children were staying. But as he had an appointment at Chicago for the Sabbath, he hastened to return. Kissing the children the last farewell, he left Rome, Pennsylvania, and took the Erie train at Waverly to Chicago. His last stop was at Hornellsville, where the strange presentiments came upon him, which were so near, persuading him to forsake the ill-fated train and take another route. Then came that ride over the lake shore and the awful plunge into the chasm at Eshtabula. His wife was with him. United in life, they were not divided in death. It is said that but a short time before, the good man was seen reading his Bible and at the hour of his death was quietly composing a hymn. The two died together as the fatal flames approached, giving their lives as a song which should reach the better land. Like martyrs, they died, singing their songs of faith, at least in their hearts, and together sharing the baptism of fire. Memorial services were held in the Tabernacle at Chicago, where he was expected on the following Sabbath, which Mr. Moody, Mr. Sankey, Reverend Dr. Goodwin, and Reverend Dr. Thompson took part. The Tabernacle was appropriately draped, and the exercises were very impressive. The funeral services were held at Towanda, Pennsylvania, the home of his mother, on Sabbath, January 7th. Reverend Dr. Goodwin of Chicago preached the sermon, and Major D.W. White gave an address full of interesting reminiscences, which brought tears to the eyes of many. At his close, Mr. Bliss' last hymn, found among his papers entitled He Knows, was sung. It breathed the full spirit of his life. So I go on in the dark, not knowing. I would not if I might. I'd rather walk with God in the dark than a walk alone in the light. I'd rather walk with him by faith than walk alone by sight. Reverend Dr. Goodwin, in speaking of this funeral afterward, said that he thanked God he had the privilege of going to it. Not a shadow had come over his face or the face of the friends whom he went to see. There was the gray-haired grandmother of 83 years, her face already shining with the light of the heaven to which she was so near. When the news were told her, she said, "Only a step has Philip gone in advance of me." The parents of Mrs. Bliss walked calm, without a murmur, through the valley of the shadow. The 30 or 40 relatives, with but one exception, all old and young, accepted Jesus Christ as the foundation upon which they stood. The faces of these bereaved ones shone as faces never shine till God comes into the heart and banishes sorrow. Whoever saw a funeral service turn to an inquiry meeting? Yet at that service, 25 persons avowed their determination to serve God, and at the evening service, 10 or 15 more did the same. Another memorial service was also held at Chicago on January 15th at Reverend Dr. Goodwin's church, where Mr. Bliss began his public life as a singer and where his memory is cherished tenderly, affectionately. The large church was crowded, nearly 3,000 people present. His pastor on this occasion paid tribute to the character of his friend. He said, "First, he was one of the most helpful men I ever knew. His life was unclouded, or at least the clouds came not to tarry. Not that he was exempt from trouble. He had his share of trial, discipline, and disappointment. He knew what it was to be misapprehended, to have mean and selfish motives imputed. He knew what it was to stand by the bedside of one who was dearer to him than life, whom he expected might at any time be called away. But his mind was in the promises of God. His heart was above the clouds and was assured of the truth. Mr. Bliss will be better known in the future as the singing pilgrim." As he went on to the Christian life, the hallelujah grew more frequent. There are a few of his songs, wherever they begin, which do not before they close. "Land us in the glory of the heavenly land. Take even light in the darkness, sailor. The last verse begins, "Bright, glorious the morning, sailor," and it ends with a glorious hallelujah. The second feature of his character was his peculiar benevolence. "I know not what proportion he set aside, but I have known the fund to amount to $1,000 in 6 months. He was unselfish in everything. His devotion was always fervent. When our old church was burning, Mr. Bliss pointed to the cross that surmounted the gable and to the great front window illuminated by the flames and asked a member of the Sunday school, 'Why will you not come over to us on the side of the cross? It never looked to me more beautiful than it does now, high above the flames, surrounded by stars, and is certain to have the victory.'" All these features culminated in the last trait. He was the gospel singer of the age. Why is it that while so many hymns pass out of mind, some like Rock of Ages, "Just As I Am," "Jesus, Lover of My Soul," have become the hymns of the Christian church? Is it not because the words of God's truth, and especially of the gospel, are in them? You do not read John Wesley's sermons, but you sing Charles Wesley's sermon and hymns. Recall some of Mr. Bliss's hymns. "I am so glad that Jesus loves me. No other name is given. There is not in the range of English hymnology one writer who put God's truth into song with the power and sweetness that Mr. Bliss has." You remember the story of Mr. Latimer, how he wandered drunk into the tabernacle and so aroused by Mr. Sankey singing, "What Shall the Harvest Be?" Throngs and throngs are yet to go up from this world to testify as the songs inspired of God while Mr. Bliss was on his knees led them to Christ. The Advance of Chicago contains the following. "It takes much from the sadness of the singer's awful death that his life was so rounded and complete. His work had been so well done that death could not surprise him and find him with his mission unaccomplished. He had made his mark, and the mark will remain. His life has stopped, and his work goes on. In every church and in every home all over the world, in years from now, when even his name may be lost, his songs will still continue to inspire faltering men and women with courage to bring consolation into the house of mourning to arouse faith in the human heart. For such a time so perfect, so successful, so far-reaching in its influences, spent it the most beneficent of labor and lost it the post of duty, there should be no tears. Other voices will take up his strains, and the work will go on without stop. Their simple beauty is not marred, nor is it their wonderful influence upon the popular heart lessened by his death. Noble and impressive in his physique, affable and genial in his contact with everyone, earnest and untiring in his work, he will long be missed as a leader in the evangelical movement, which is now stirring popular heart. But he has left his impress upon the world with results more lasting than the work achieved by heroes of the battlefield or masters of statecraft. His harp is forever silent, his voice is forever hushed, but the songs which he sang could never die. Their melody, like the brook, goes on forever. The following is the testimony of some of the more important witnesses before the coroner's jury. It was taken from the shorthand report made at the time, but abridged as much as possible. Mr. A.L. Rogers testifies, I was foreman of the raising of the bridge, superintended the screwing of nuts to bring the strain upon the vertical rods. A mass of stone examined it and said my part of the work was well done. After knocking out the blocks, the bridge settled 6 inches. It settled gradually as we put in thinner blocks and took them out to put in still thinner ones. It was not in use during this time. Mr. Stoneman decided to reconstruct the bridge by changing the position of certain irons and braces. Bridge was constructed after this design, with one exception, the struts running from the bottom cord to the middle of the first pair of braces were not put in till afterward. A change was made in the arrangement of the upper cords, which were shortened. After these changes, Mr. Stone examined it without taking out the blocks and pronounced it good. The false work remained in position from October 1865 to November 1866. Cross-examined when the bridge was first put up is settled, and it made the remark that if it kept on, it would go into the creek. Perhaps I told it to half a dozen others, said it was not. Mr. Collins' bridge, but Mr. Stone's, said the bridge had cost a great deal of money, but don't recollect saying it would cost the company a great deal more. Was discouraged because the bridge acted so and that I couldn't see how to remedy it. Remember, all this was before the modifications were made. Mr. Congdon was with Mr. Stone when the bridge was examined. The plan of changing the braces was then adopted. Mr. Albert Congdon testified as follows. At the time of the construction of this bridge, I was employed by the Lakeshore Road as master machinist. Knew something about the construction of this bridge as I was had charge of the work. In making the bridge, found a lack of material to fill the place for which it was designed. Told Mr. Thompson about it, and he wanted to know if he had better let Mr. Stone know it. Told him he had better. Short time afterward, I was told to take the plans and finish the construction of the bridge as I thought it should be done. Do not know how far the work had progressed. At the time, I assumed control. The braces were not marked so as to designate the position they were to occupy. Never calculated the strength of the tension of compression members, did not say much to Mr. Tomlinson or any other man about the bridge, as I did not consider myself a competent bridge man. From the time of Mr. Tomlinson's leaving, I had the management of constructing the bridge. Mr. Rogers told me that Mr. Stone had given him orders to erect it, but he did not know how. I asked him why he did not go and tell Mr. Stone so, and he said that he did not like to. I then told him as much as I knew. Testimony of the man who drew the plans for the Ashtabula Bridge. Joseph Tomlinson is sworn, resides in Ottawa, Ontario, is general superintendent of lighthouses in the employ of the Canadian government, was engaged in bridge building from 1840 to 1870. He made the drawings for the Iron How Truss Bridge over Ashtabula Creek, the one which had lately fallen. He did this under instructions from Mr. Stone. He never approved of a wrought iron how truss over a large span. It makes an unnecessarily heavy bridge, and all the strain accumulates at the end braces. Notwithstanding its weight, It would have been a strong, durable bridge had the main braces been sufficiently strong. They were not made as large as designed, and it was his intention that they should be strengthened. But his connection with the company was severed on account of a difference that arose between himself and Mr. Stone concerning the bridge. Mr. A. Gottlieb, engineer of the Keystone Bridge Company at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, was next called. He testifies as follows. When the wrecked bridge was constructed, the building of iron truss bridges was in its childhood compared with the progress made since that time. The first objectionable point in the bridge, therefore, was the unnecessarily great dead weight. The second, the lack of sufficient section in the upper cord. Also, the manner in which the beams forming said cord were bound together, which brought much more strain on some of them than on others. Made a careful exam of the wrecked bridge as it lay at the bottom of the river, and also the map of the bridge as made by Mr. Tomlinson. I think I have obtained a very good idea of the construction of the wrecked bridge. I do not think that the Howe truss pattern is very well adapted to a heavy iron bridge. During my exam, I did not see anything in the plan or construction of the bridge that would lead me to think that the extremes of heat or cold would injure it. I never knew of any other wrought iron bridge constructed on the Howe or Howe truss pattern. Before the committee appointed by the legislature of Ohio, following testimony was also given by Mr. Amasa Stone, the former president of the road. Mr. Stone swore that he designed the bridge, only superintended the drawing of the plan, while the details of construction were given into the hands of Mr. Albert Congdon, who was supervised by Mr. Joseph Tomlinson. I've never constructed any other Howe truss bridge with wrought iron braces and know of no other anywhere in the country. When Mr. Rogers made the mistake of putting in the braces, it was not negligence in permitting him to continue the superintendence of the erection of the bridge, for there was no other particular in which he could have made a mistake. It was not even unwise to permit him to continue. When the bridge was changed in correcting the mistake, there was no more braces inserted. Charles Collins, the engineer of the road, testified before the same committee as follows. About the time the bridge was built, my duties were so heavy I was relieved from looking after the bridge. I never mentioned to anyone that the bridge was not mine and that I did not want anything to do with it since it was placed under the charge of a bridge man. I thought it out of place for me to say anything about it. I never knew of another bridge being built of wrought iron on this plan. I think the bridge was rather an experiment. The bridge was the crucial element in the Ashtabula Horror and became the subject of endless speculation. Over the years, investigatory panels, professional engineers, and amateur train enthusiasts have pondered the train, the cold, the snow, the weaknesses of the bridge, and wondered why it fell. The Ashtabula River Bridge, known then as the Ashtabula Creek Bridge, which fell apart the night of December 29, 1876, was a replacement for a wooden Howe truss bridge that previously occupied the site. Erected 11 years earlier, the new structure was designed by the president of the Cleveland, Painesville, and Ashtabula Railroad, Amasa Stone, a partner with his brother-in-law, Elias Howe, in the Howe Bridge and Truss Company. Stone, an expert in wooden bridges designed for the Ashtabula, an innovative span worth of iron. It happened that Stone's brother, Andros B. Stone, was a partner in the Cleveland Iron Works, chosen to provide the I-beams for the bridge's superstructure. Stone hired Joseph Tomlinson to develop design specifications for the individual bridge members to draw up detailed shop drawings for fabrication and to supervise construction. As a civil engineer who had done contract bridge building since 1846, Tomlinson was well qualified. The design Stone handed off to Tomlinson placed the superstructure consisting of two iron Howe trusses below track level, the bridge's deck to rest directly on the upper cord, and the tracks to be placed so the train would load 90% of one truss and only 10% of the other. Tomlinson's specifications called for a 6-inch camber in the bridge's upper cord or deck. Camber is a slight upward arch in the bridge deck, which tends to flatten out when bearing a load. The main diagonal bracing would be an I-beams 260 inches long, 6 inches high, and flanges 4 inches wide. This bracing would interlock into lugs on angle blocks in the bridge, the upper cord, and attach to tensioning braces forming the lower cord. The bridge's upper cord consisted of segments which were two panels long, and with the same angle blocks, the diagonal braces were set. One specification issued by Stone was to proportion the structure such that it would bear 8,000 pounds per square inch in tension and 8,000 pounds per square inch in compression. Okay, and the specification for the compression elements were the source of conflict between Stone and Tomlinson, since Tomlinson figured 8,000 pounds per square inch on the compression elements would actually bend the diagonal I-beams. The diagonals arrived at the original construction site undersized, so Tomlinson went to Stone with proposals to reinforce the diagonals. When Stone would not hear of any changes, Tomlinson resigned from the project. Erecting the bridge. With Tomlinson gone, Stone chose to supervise construction himself rather than assign the task to Charles Collins, chief engineer of the railroad. Stone felt that with vast experience building wooden bridges and a few with iron, completing the Asheville Bridge would be a crowning achievement to his career. The task of erecting the bridge was assigned to A.L. Rogers, a carpenter who built and repaired wooden bridges for the railroad, but who never worked on an iron bridge. Rogers was most likely chosen because Stone believed him to be competent and that the bridge was to be built of iron. He considered of little or no consequence. Rogers worked with roadmaster mechanic Albert Congdon, a man with extensive iron experience. Rogers' first task was to build the false work or temporary support upon which the bridge was to be erected. At first, with Congdon's recommendation, Rogers planned a camber in the false work of 5 to 7 inches. Such a camber concurred generally with Tomlinson's design speculation of 6 inches. However, Stone told Rogers the bridge was never designed for that much camber and that correct value should be a half inch to the panel. To comply, Rogers changed the camber of the false work to 3 1/2 inches. At this point, the first erection problem presented itself. When a camber of 3 1/2 inches were used instead of the 6 inches called for by Tomlinson, the I-beams for the upper cord were too long to fit between the angle blocks. Rogers' strategy for this was to shorten the members of the upper cord of each truss. After the correction was completed, the final task was to screw up the vertical rods to pre-stress each truss. When Rogers began to remove the false work due to the shortened cords, the bridge had deflected or yielded 2 1/2 inches below the horizontal. Or considering the deflection, removal of the false work was halted for fear the bridge might fall. To remedy the problem, Stone entered the upper cords returned to their original lengths using shims. The shims fit because Rogers reportedly changed the bridge camber back to 6 inches as originally specified by Tomlinson. The bridge was then pre-stressed with the vertical adjustment rods before a second attempt at removing the supporting false work. However, inadvertently, some diagonals were pre-stressed to the buckling point, thus proceeding with the second attempt to remove the false work when several diagonals began to buckle. Rogers halted the process. At this point, Stone ordered additional diagonal braces to enforce the third end panels to prevent them from buckling. It's likely that Stone reflected on Tomlinson's concerns regarding the possible buckling of the diagonals when under stress. to accommodate the additional diagonals, two modifications were made. In the first modification, lugs on the upper cord's angle blocks, which were to hold the diagonals in position, were removed to make room for the additional beams. In the second modification, ends of some diagonal braces were chipped away to allow clearance for the vertical iron rods. Put simply, the diagonal bracing on the three panels on each end did not have a square bearing on their respective angle blocks and had no mechanical restraint, only friction to hold their position. Friction is a restraint method commonly reliable with wooden howe trusses. After these changes, Rogers made a third attempt at pre-stressing the bridge and removing the falsework. At this time, the bridge stood on its own, bearing its own weight without buckling any diagonal bracing. After a single track was laid on the bridge deck, three 60,000-pound locomotives crossed in a test, and the bridge was placed in service. Later, a second track was added, and many persons subsequently testified that they thought the bridge safe for one track, but unable to bear two. Two points of unknown significance should be mentioned. Number one, Chief Engineer Collins never specified on what optimum length of time between bridge inspections. Two, Gustavus Folsom, engineer of the Columbia, who rode his engine down with the bridge and who survived, later reported the bridge at times snapped as if the joints were settling together as he crossed. Folsom also reported that all the snaps could be heard. They could not be felt. December 29, 1876, had dawned with a lake effect snowstorm, pelting northeast Ohio, northwest Pennsylvania, and western New York. Such lake effect storms were common then, as they are now throughout the Great Lakes region, caused typically by cold Canadian air blowing across warm lake waters. At dusk, the snow was still falling with blinding fury, and the temperature declined to 16 degrees after a daytime high of 27. Wind velocity between Erie, Pennsylvania, and Cleveland, Ohio, between 8 p.m. and 9 p.m. was reported at 20 to 54 miles per hour. In Ashtabula, roads were impassable due to drifting snow, and businesses closed early due to the storm. The station and facilities of the LS and MS Railway remained in operation. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, the Pacific Express departed Erie, Pennsylvania, 2.5 hours late, requiring the assistance of two pusher locomotives. Through the late afternoon and into the evening, engineers Dan McGuire and Pap Folsom ran their locomotives through what Folsom called the worst storm he had ever experienced along the lakeshore and Michigan Southern. Snowfall in Ashtabula was from 12 to 36 inches, depending on the severity of drifting. Not until midnight did the snow subside to light flurries. As the Pacific Express rounded the final turn to the bridge at 15 miles per hour through the snow, engineer Dan McGuire saw faint blurred lights of the Asheville station ahead, and as the train proceeded routinely onto the bridge. Time was 7:28 p.m. as Socrates crossed the second panel's point from the west abutment of the bridge. McGuire heard a sharp crack, similar to the torpedo signaling device, and suddenly, as he kept his eye focused forward, he had the sensation of running uphill. Instinctively, McGuire grabbed the throttle handle and pulled it wide open so the Socrates safely reached the west abutment, severing its coupling to the Columbia. McGuire looked back with horror to see the Columbia and the rest of the train lurching wildly and seeming to hang in suspense for an instant before spilling into the gulf below. What was actually happening, as experts later sorted out, was the coming apart of the bridge at its south truss fell away, starting at the second panel's point from the west abutment. The Socrates had caused the bridge deck to lean south, causing the tender of the Socrates and the trailing Columbia to derail. Then, as the north truss began to fall, resorted the leaning bridge deck. the bridge's superstructure landed in the river on the north side of the bridge, whereupon the north truss completely failed, landing north of the bridge site. The bridge deck and track dropped straight downward with the Columbia, both express cars and part of the first baggage on top of it. Eventually, it became clear that the first express car had lurched forward and landed at the foot of the west abutment, while the Columbia landed to the south side of the west abutment, slid down the bank adjacent to the abutment, and landed upside down, falling onto the first express car. The second express car and two baggage cars fell to the side of the bridge and formed a line across the ravine with the rear baggage car against the east abutment. The first passenger coach landed in an upright position in the middle of the river near the bridge wreckage. The second passenger coach struck ground at an angle and turned on its side, coming to rest atop the bridge wreckage on the north. It was crushed and broken in the fall. The smoking car struck across the second passenger coach, smashing it before falling on top of the first coach, caving it in. The Yokohama, the drawing room car, fell clear of the east abutment, ending up on the ice to the left of the bridge, 80 feet away. The sleeper Palatine landed beside the Yokohama to the right. So the Buffalo struck the Yokohama and the Palatine in midair, knocking the Yokohama on its side, crushing it throughout its entire length. The city of Buffalo came to rest on its forward end, its rear end high in the air, leaning against both the Yokohama and the Palatine. The sleeper Osgiel ended up near the Palatine in the middle of the river. Those who could escape did so within minutes. Passengers trapped in the wreckage soon faced a horrible confrontation with flames erupting from the train's heating stoves. From a careful consideration of the evidence elicited from professionals and experts that our verdict is made up in the manner of the bridge, and it seems severe upon the railway company or upon any of its past or present officials, is because the truth, as shown by the evidence, demands it in our hands. We cannot do less than feel that we have discharged our duty. Mr. Amasa Stone, president of the company at the time of the erection of this structure, had been for years a prominent and successful railroad contractor and builder of wooden plow truss bridges. With the undoubted intention of building a strong, safe, and durable wrought iron bridge upon the Howe truss plan, he designed the structure, dictating the drawing of the plans of the erection of the bridge without the approval of any competent engineer, against the protest of the man who made the drawings under Mr. Stowe's direction, assuming the role and entire responsibility himself. Iron bridges were then in their infancy, and this one was an experiment which ought never to have been tried or trusted to span so broad and so deep a chasm. This experiment had been a fearful cost of human life and human suffering. Unquestionably, Mr. Stone had great confidence in his own abilities and believed he could build and had built a structure which would prove the crowning glory of an active life and enduring monument to his name. That the officials of the railroad regarded the bridge as safe, we have no doubt, as two of them were on the train that went down and all were more or less frequently passing over it. That the fall of the bridge was the result of defects and errors made in designing, constructing, and erecting it. That's a great defect, said one which appears in many parts of the structure, was a dependence of every member for its efficient action upon the probability that all or nearly all the others would retain their position and do the duty for which they were designed. Instead of giving each member a positive connection with the rest, which nothing but a direct rupture could sever, that the railway company used and continued to use this bridge about 11 years, during all which time a careful inspection by a competent bridge engineer could not have failed to discover the defects. For the neglect of such careful inspection, the railway company alone is responsible. That the responsibility of this fearful disaster and its consequent loss of life rests upon the railway company, which by its chief executive officer planned and erected this bridge, that the cars in which the deceased passengers were carried into the chasm were not heated by heating apparatus so constructed that the fire in them would be immediately extinguished whenever the cars were thrown off of the track and overturned, that their failure to comply with the plain requirements of the law places the responsibility of the origin of the fire upon the railway company, that the responsibility for not putting out the fire at the time it first made its appearance in the wreck rests upon those who were the first to arrive at the scene of the disaster and who seemed to have been so overwhelmed by the fearful calamity they lost all presence of mind and failed to use the means at hand, consisting of the steam pump in the pumping house and the fire engine Lake Erie and its hose, which might have been attached to the steam pump in time to save life. The steamer belonging to the fire department and also the protection fire engine were hauled more than a mile through a blinding snowstorm and over roads rendered almost impassable by the drifted snow and arrived on the ground too late to save human life, but nothing should have prevented the chief engineer from making all possible efforts to extinguish what fire there remained. For his failure to do this, he is responsible. The persons deceased whose bodies were identified and those whose bodies and parts of bodies were unidentified came to their death by the precipitation of the aforesaid cars in which they were riding into the chasm in the valley of Eschewa Creek, left by the falling of the bridge, as aforesaid, the crushing and burning of cars aforesaid, for all of which the railway company is responsible. January 12, 1877, the legislature of Ohio passed a resolution that a joint committee be appointed to investigate the cause or causes of the recent accident. The joint committee and civil engineers Benjamin F. Bowen, Thomas H. Johnson, and John Graham reported to the legislature January 30, 1877. The engineers made the following criticisms of the design. Number one, the Howe truss would be made safe for a 150-foot iron span, but would be excessively heavy. Number two, the comprehensive diagonal braces were intermixed with different sizes, creating unique stress levels in each brace of the same diagonal. Three, the end bearings, due to design modifications, were not square and tended to be rounded. Four, there were no positive physical conditions between the braces and angle blocks to prevent movement. Five, the comprehensive elements of the top core of the bridge were intermixed with different sized I-beams that were not continuously tied together. Number six, the cord was placed in flexure by train loads and was laterally braced at every other panel point. Number seven, the vertical X bracing between trusses and between the top and bottom cords of the bridge were determined to be inadequate. Eight, the vertical lugs on the angle blocks would have been stronger had they been continuous. The engineers reported that failure of the Eschewa Bridge occurred in the second and third panels of the south truss, counting from the west abutment. They did not estimate the snow load and considered the load from the wind to be negligible, even though it's reported as being of the engineers' work. The failure was not due to any effective quality in the iron. It was not owing to the sudden effect of intense cold for failure occurring by bending and not by breaking. It was not the result of a weakness gradually developed after the erection of the bridge. It was due simply to the fact that it was not constructed in accordance with certain well-established engineering principles. A mass of stone testified before the joint committee and adamantly denied any wrongdoing, stating that the bridge design was sound. Stone's explanation of the collapse was that the train derailed upon the bridge and caused it to fall. Another reason he gave was that the snowstorm that hit Eschewa created a tornado that smashed the bridge as the Pacific Express crossed. Engineer Albert H. Howland, likely on behalf of the coroner's jury in Eschewa, reported to the Joint Committee February 12, 1877, concluding that failure occurred at the second set of vertical rods counting from west to east. He believed failure likely resulted from the buckling outward of the three I-beams that were continuous at one point. Okay. The Joint Committee drafted provisions for the bill to be brought before the Ohio legislature. The provisions included a bridge design code, required bridge specifications, and expert preview of design, construction supervision, and periodic inspection by engineers. The proposed expert reviewer was to be an individual who passed an exam given by a panel of at least three members of the American Society of Civil Engineers. The Ohio legislature, likely as a result of Amasa Stone's and the railroad's collective influence, never made the provisions into law. Curiously, Chief Engineer Charles Collins was found dead from a gunshot wound to the head from an apparent suicide just days after testimony before the Joint Committee. A subsequent autopsy reported, however, that given the angle of the points of entry, the wounds were inconsistent with suicide. A left murder are the only possibility, but the autopsy report was quietly buried, only to be discovered nearly a century later. Later, Amasa Stone also committed suicide May 10, 1883, likely because of public opinion, blaming him for the Ashtabula Bridge disaster. Tyler Dennett, a biographer, wrote that Stone had lived over into a technological age, which he did not understand, and for which a carpenter's rule of thumb was not sufficient. Yet, Charles McDonald conducted a third investigation of the bridge failure, American Society of Civil Engineers. He reported his findings to the ASCE on February 21, 1877. McDonald agreed with other engineers regarding calculations of static and live loads on the bridge. He also reported in candid fashion that the breaking resistance limits of the diagonal I-beams were 13,300 pounds per square inch, as designed, and as low as 4,433 pounds per square inch, assuming the beam ends to be completely rounded, described in some testimonies. McDonald stated that there was nothing to use as a guide to determine where the actual breaking resistance lay between these limits. He went further in stating the value of 4,433 pounds per square inch value was so low the bridge would never have stood on its own. He concluded the breaking resistance was generally adequate given that the bridge had been in continuous service for 11 years prior to the disaster. McDonald was the only investigating engineer to have discovered a flaw with the bridge's superstructure. In his report, McDonald stated the cast iron angle block, top of the second set of braces, had the south lug broken off close to the face and the line of fracture disclosed an air hole extending over one-half the entire section. Based on this evidence, he reported his conclusion, failure first began in the south truss. At the second panel point from the west abutment at the second top cord angle block, whose south lug was impaired by an air hole as to be reduced in strength fully one-half. McDonald showed that after repeated load cycles over the course of 11 years, of service, the south lug was subjected to severe fatigue stress. The cold, 16 degrees Fahrenheit on December 29, 1876, caused the fracture strength of the cast iron on the south lug to be considerably reduced. Given these two facts, McDonald's conclusion was reported as that the load force generated by the locomotive Socrates and Columbia caused the south lug of the second angle block to become unstable and shear off. Given the lack of positive mechanical connections in the Ashtabula Bridge's superstructure, the broken lug caused the I-beams supporting the bridge deck to bow outward in a southerly direction and to sink slightly until the compressive diagonal beam slipped away from the underside of the second angle block, thereby setting up a cascade failure of the remaining angle blocks and support beams in the bridge's superstructure. McDonald recommended the inspection of bridges by professionals only and called for studies on the behavior of compressive elements in bridges. By 1888, bridge standards for design forbade the use of cast iron on any part of a bridge structure. In the years to follow, no bridges of steel or iron were built of a design in which the components of said bridge acted in an independent manner to maintain structural integrity. All components were designed and built to act as one by providing a positive connection between the braces, counter braces, and other bridge components to provide the intended strength and durability necessary in a railroad environment. Also by 1888, the use of the cast iron in the bridge design superstructure was forbidden. The LS and MS by the early 1900s eliminated a majority of The long bridges on its main line, similar to the one in Ashtabula, was fill at large culverts, some 30 to 40 feet in length, as part of its four-track main line project. The death of rail baron Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt occurred in January 1877. Vanderbilt, who has been in a poor health for many years, was controlling shareholder of the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad and the LS and MS Railway. While no one knows for certain, his death may have been hastened by the horror and suddenness of the tragedy in Ashtabula. Government legislation in the years that followed created the Interstate Commerce Commission, ICC, whose original purpose was to regulate safety and investigate accidents of the American railroad companies. The ICC in time gave way to the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Railroad Administration as the governing body of railway safety. Time of the disaster, Ashtabula, Cleveland, and Lorain were the prominent cities in northern Ohio and were approximately equivalent in population and physical size. As a result of the disaster, growth in the city of Ashtabula was almost brought to a halt, and significant growth was delayed until the early 20th century. Cleveland and Lorain in the late 19th century grew into large cities while Ashtabula remained in a semi-state of stagnation. The lack of growth may result from Ashtabula becoming synonymous with the worst rail disaster in history. Growth in Ashtabula Harbor continued throughout the late 19th century under the development of the LSMS Railway and Ashtabula, Youngstown, and Pittsburgh Railroad. To commemorate the 20th century anniversary of the accident, the citizens of Ashtabula and LS and MS Railway Company erected a granite monument in Chestnut Grove Cemetery in memory of the unrecognized dead. As a result of the accident, the need for a hospital became apparent, and Ashtabula citizens built the city's first hospital at a site a quarter mile north of the bridge. This site was chosen as it was central to the LS and MS's Ashtabula Railroad Yards and stations, the Ashtabula Youngstown and Pittsburgh's Ashtabula Railroad Yards, and the docks served by both railroads in Ashtabula Harbor. Approximately 10 years after the disaster, the LS and MS Railroad Company adopted the use of steam heat in all passenger cars, replacing the dangerous wood coal stoves responsible for the fires at Ashtabula and other notable 19th century railroad accidents. Today, passenger cars are heated with electrical heating appliances. The narrative of this great disaster is finished. Space does not admit of the addition of further material. All that remains is to be said of a religious nature. Mr. Devereaux, as representative of the Friends of the Road, beautifully alert to Moses as chief civil engineer. So we, in conclusion, go to the Word of God for the lesson of the hour. Moses went up the mountain and received the patterns of all things which were to be made, but the Israelites were not permitted to transgress, the pattern said at the base, lest they die. Skill in art and architecture was in those days regarded as an inspiration from God, as was proved in the case of Bezalel, who had knowledge of all inventions. In our day, we have invaded the region of storms and have thought to seize the forces which belong to the Almighty, but the result has been death, death unforeseen, unexpected, appalling, heartrending. Men have found by hard experience it's dangerous to lay hold of these grand elements of nature till they have become more reverent, conscientious, God-fearing, and unselfish, but they're not fit to enter the dangerous precincts which the Almighty dwells. In some ways, even in knowledge is attained, the sin and selfishness of men and women will bring the lightnings and the fire out of the mountain, and men shall surely die. The great forces of nature have a sacredness about them, and the laws of the universe an inviolability, which will admit of no wantonness or careless handling for selfish ends. But until a sense of accountability to God prevails, the safety of property and of human life cannot be secured. No coroner's jury, no legislative committee, no congressional enactment will make men realize how sacred are many of these responsibilities of life. The haste to get rich and the desire to make men serve the purpose of money and the control over many to the enrichment of the few will destroy the sense of accountability and blind men so that they run profanely into the very place where God has the hidings of his power. But The result is that they do not know how to handle the lightnings and to control the storms, and they are appalled at the calamities which their own temerity has brought down. People must understand that with this control over the elements, the increase of knowledge and power, there's no safety anywhere except in God. So that this lesson has to be impressed by many deaths when it's taught by everyone. The terrible experiences of many concentrate because we will not listen to the hints given gently to each of us. The storms and hurricanes and great shocks and calamities and horrid deaths come because we will not listen to wisdom, and yet God is not in the storm or in the earthquake, but is in the still small voice. It's indeed well to say that safety must be secured, selfishness shall be rebuked, laws should be studied, skill employed. This blundering, heedless, reckless mode of life must be stopped. But where in all the advance of art and education has there appeared immunity from accidents or safety from death? No, with all the conservatism which may be advocated, with all the plans for skilled labor, and with all the attainment of knowledge, there is not need of that which God alone can give, even the bringing in of a better hope. There were no vanities, errors, or perversities to bring construction from out of the elements which men had not learned to control. Even then death would come. There must be a higher life which is not subject to the destructive forces. The mercy of God and the deliverance wrought out for us by his Son has respect as much to the material creation as to the moral state. In some way, we shall attain to a further control of the unseen forces and shall know more of the great laws of God. But happy are we if the death which must come shall be like that of Moses, who after his long wanderings and faithful discharge of duty went up to Mount Pisgah and looked over the promised inheritance to which the people should enter, but he himself took up his dwelling place with God. May heaven in mercy grant us never to see such a night and a day of horror again. Editor, Eshtabula News, January 3, 1877. The 1876 accident in Eshtabula had all the elements of a classic tragedy. Cold, snowy weather that lent eeriness to the dark of night, height, as in the 70 feet from the bridge to the river, modern technology in an experimental iron bridge, mechanical power in locomotives, human beings fighting for their lives, fire, water, and ice all at once, the evil of robbers preying on the injured and dying, the good in heroes and heroines who risked their lives to rescue the needy, the event striking the unknown, and the world famous such as P.P. Bliss. It is difficult to imagine a worse happening to a little village of 2,500 citizens.
It was 145 years ago, on a cold winter's night, snow was blowing. The wind was blowing. When the number 5 train entering Eshtabula, Ohio, rounded the last curve, approached the Eshtabula Bridge, crossing the Eshtabula Gorge, when, with P.P. Bliss, the well-known gospel songwriter, and many others on board, felt the bridge below them collapse, and the train began to fall. They didn't know what was happening. They didn't realize, for many of them, this was their last moments alive. As the train plunged into the Eshtabula Gorge, 76 feet below, the train wrecked, falling into the gorge below. Screams were heard as the injured were hurt. Then the great fire, as the cars began to burn. The question was, why was not the fire put out? Many other questions were asked. Why did the bridge collapse? In this disaster, the most horrible at the time, of the Ashtabula Railroad Bridge disaster, known as the Ashtabula Horror, the worst of its disasters at the time. Find out as we research the details here on the Six Eyes Radio Network on December 30, 2021, January 6, 2022, and January 13th, 2022. Join us by calling 424-243-9617, 424-243-9617. Just press the number 1, join the conversation, and find out for yourself what happened on that most horrible disaster known as the Ashtabula Horror or the Ashtabula Train Disaster. Amen.
All right, Ruth, and who do we got with us tonight?
Well, at present, we have the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Band of Angels. We have you, Brother Jim, and me.
All right. Well, considering probably he'll had no questions, and we, after doing our own research, already know most about this, you could give any comments you want to give, and I'm pretty much done.
I've just been doing a little bit of reflection on it because I lived on Grove Drive, and the street was where I went up there and saw that monument quite often of the unrecognized dead. And it was very hard. My friend Tim Groover came from where he lives in Scranton Islands, and he also thought it was quite rough to note about, because not only P.P. Bliss was a very good writer of songs, but, you know, he put so many beautiful ones together that he's really going to be a blessing to others to, you know, talk about that. And I think it was really wonderful. Today I was thinking about it when I was walking with my wheelchair over to a doctor's appointment and coming back that way, too, because that area was where it went past, but it also, it was near, closer to another area. As you go farther down, you would be able to look at that particular area. It's just a sad thing that happened. But, you know, when you think about it, the Lord's with us, and hopefully this will never happen again. So I just think it was very difficult to do the research, because some of it actually almost made me feel like crying, because there were parts that I saw that was very rough. Okay,
well,
and Jim or Emily, I guess, want to say something. Emily's here.
Okay.
Hey, Kenny.
Yeah, go ahead.
That the 3 weeks of this Ashtabula Bridge disaster, there is stuff that came out in this that I wasn't even aware of, you know. And it's enough just listening to it, knowing the horror these people went through, and knowing they had the fire people there that could have put it out. But to me, knowing that whoever the head over the fire people were at point gave the order, don't put water on it, proves to me that that person had no kind of heart for anybody.
Yeah, and it also, according to the research, he was a alcoholic, a drunkard, and that might have played a part in that.
Yep, somebody that was probably blitzed off their gourd, didn't need to be on the job drinking or on the job intoxicated.
That's for sure. And, hey, a disaster like this, Emily, just like others, okay, just like the Space Shuttle Challenger, Apollo 13, Columbia, Space Shuttle Columbia, Chernobyl, Bhopal, all of these disasters, when you study them out, they could teach you something. And the lesson you learn in common with all of them, it's not the big thing. It's not the whole disaster as a whole. But if you look, even in this bridge disaster, it was the small things. There was a bolt or lug that was had half of its circumference lost due to an air hole, which was compromised and caused it to compromise the bridge. And then you add to that the cold. Then you add to that the fact that they did not put out the fire. And you add to that the fact that they had wood-burning stoves on the train. So you add all those things together, makes it what it ended up being. But they were all small things by themselves, but added together, they made a big thing. And that's what you learn.
Exactly. And the fact that somebody was there on singing that could have told them, put this fire out, but they were more worried about being intoxicated and getting tipsy, or beyond being tipsy, that had no regard for human life.
Right. And on top of that, they were more worried about letting the thing burn so that those who were on the train couldn't be identified so that they could avoid lawsuits.
Exactly. They were more worried about doing a quick cremation so nobody would get sued.
Yeah, so the whole point being it was wrong no matter how you slice it.
You know, they were concerned about the steam issue, too. It's going to create steam. Well, yeah, think about something else. What would you feel like if you were dying and you were burning? They didn't think about anything like that.
Well, let me give a little science here for everybody, okay? True enough, the first onslaught of water would have caused steam when you got fire, okay? Anybody knows that. You take a hot pan and you pour water onto a hot pan, into a hot pan, you get steam. But as you continue to pour water into it, it doesn't continue to make steam. It cools down and you have water. Well, the same thing. If they would have put water on the fire and continued to pour water, the fire would have went out. But they weren't thinking of that. It had to do with lawsuits. In the back of their mind, that's what they were more worried about than they were worried about putting out the fire and worried about steam. That there was just an excuse. It was just an excuse, not reality, because the minute they would have started water on it and they would have continued water on it, it would have put it out. It would not have continued as steam. Anybody knows that knows anything about science. I mean, it's plain to see. It would have not continued as steam.
Another point, Kenny, that the way they talked and talked so much about this, that they made it like all these people were feeling bad. But, you know, think about really... You see that monument, it's like a, how would you put it, a special thing to these people that were there. If there was any even indication that was going to happen, I think people would have never got on the train that night. You know, if they had any indication that they shouldn't have got on it. There's even some comments in that in the books I read, too.
Well, the whole point comes down to you, Ruth. Just like many other disasters, okay? Like the people around Chernobyl, if they knew that the bozos manhandling the controls that night were doing what they did, they would have left and gotten way far away from Chernobyl, okay? But they didn't. Some of them were working in the actual building when it occurred, okay? By the same token, the astronauts who were on the Space Shuttle Challenger, had they known that those O-rings were going to have problems seating, they would have refused to get on that January flight. They would have said, forget this, we're not doing this. We're not flying when it's unsafe. But they had no clue. See, so your point is valid, Ruth, okay? Your point is very valid. If they had foreknowledge, they probably wouldn't have gotten on that train. But unfortunately, there is no such thing as a fortune teller. There are prophets in the Bible who know ahead of time of certain things that are going to happen. But what they are endued by the Spirit of God to foretell things that are going to happen in the future, but they don't foretell disasters to say, hey, don't go on X. They foretold, for example, kings, if they don't obey God, that a certain disaster would be coming. Do you follow, Ruth?
Yeah, and pretty much also when you think about the Titanic, that was another disaster, like you're saying, Chernobyl. If they would have known, they wouldn't have got on. But there's many other things that went on with that, too. I mean, if you ever read a book or watched a movie on it, there's a lot of things there that really got messed up.
And once again, with Titanic, yes, it was an iceberg that hit it. But there was other smaller problems when you study it. There were other smaller problems that contributed to its disaster, too. Had they had better way of steerage, it could have steered quicker to get away from that thing. Had they had appropriate eye goggles, you know, the field glasses for the men.
Binoculars, Kenny.
Binoculars, that's what I was looking for the word. Had they had enough binoculars for the men that were watching ahead, they could have saw in enough advanced time the iceberg. Had they obeyed people that were warning them they were headed toward that field, and had they listened to the warnings to other people, see, there were lots of small things, but they were trying to break a speed record and trying to show off, et cetera, et cetera. And they thought, well, this is an unsinkable ship, and they were too prideful. Once again, that's how it sank. Well, sometimes pride and technology just don't cut together.
Yeah, and if we look back more at this bridge disaster, train disaster, that Mr. Collins is buried up there in the mausoleum, some people think of that as, you know, it was his fault, and there was things said that he was committed suicide, and they found out later the way that the pistol was sitting, they knew he was murdered. So, you know, that's a sad thing, that the guy was murdered. He was just an engineer. He didn't plot anything.
Yep. So when you think about that, see, I mean, a lot of things fell into place on this that could have been, I mean, been done better, but unfortunately, it turned out bad, but we can learn from it. And we could take the lessons home for ourselves. I know, what lesson can we take home for our own personal lives? Well, first off, as the scripture says, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. That's exactly what they had. They thought, well, we know what we're doing. We got these engineering degrees, blah, blah, blah. And they built a bridge which they did not continue to inspect. They continued to use it without inspections, etc. Had they done that, had they not been so prideful, they might have caught the problem before it became a problem. But they didn't do that. So teaches us you can't, that pride can mess you up big time. See, a good little lesson for us all.
Yeah, we should learn to be more humble like Jesus.
Amen. All right. Got any other comments, Ruthie?
I think I'm cool.
How about you, Em?
I'm good.
All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to say good night, God bless, and we'll catch you tomorrow for the Talk with Missionary Ken and Ruth Wolfgang Show, 9 p.m. only here at the Successor Radio Network. And then, of course, the open programming on Saturday, Sunday, 1 p.m. for the Sunday Gospel Show. And then, of course, Monday at 9 p.m. for Motivational Monday. Tuesday, the Word of the King, 8 p.m. Wednesday at 7 p.m. for the Wednesday night Bible study in the Six Eyes Gospel Bus. Thursday, again, we'll be back once again, the Jumbo Braille program with you once again next week. So God bless, good night for Six Eyes and all the gang, and we ask you to just join us again. Amen. Catch you later.
Bless everyone.
Catch y'all later.